This is no mortal business. The man occupied us all in life and is still holding on to his claim. Now we will have to carry away his sea-changed parts, rich and strange, to our different quarters. Estranged, disarranged, we spend our darkest hours staring at those pearls, those coral bones. Is this the stuff I came from? How many of his sins belong also to me? How much of his punishment? Rachel seems incapable of remorse, but she is not. She wears those pale white eyes around her neck so she can look in every direction and ward off the attack. Leah took it all, bones, teeth, scalp, and knitted herself something like a hair shirt. Mother's fabrication is so elaborate I can hardly describe it. It occupies so much space in her house she must step carefully around it in the dark. Having served enough time in Atlanta with her volunteer work, Mother has moved to the Georgia coast, to a hamlet of hoary little brick houses on Sanderling Island. But she carried the sunken treasure along to her little place by the shore. She stays outdoors a lot, I think, to escape it. When I go to visit, I always find her out in her walled garden with her hands sunk into the mulch, kneading the roots of her camellias. If she isn't home, I walk down to the end of the historic cobbled street and find her standing on the seawall in her raincoat and no shoes, glaring at the ocean. Orleana and Africa at a standoff. The kids flying by on bicycles steer clear of this barefoot old woman and her plastic babushka, but I can tell you she is not deranged. My mother's sanest position is to wear only the necessary parts of the outfit and leave off the rest. Shoes would interfere with her conversation, for she constantly addresses the ground under her feet, asking forgiveness. Owning, disowning, recanting, recharting a hateful course of events to make sense of her own complicity. We all are, I suppose, trying to invent our version of the story. All human odes are essentially one. My life, what I stole from history, and how I live with it. Personally, I have stolen an arm and a leg. I am still A-D-A-H Ada, but you would hardly know me now without my slant. I walk without any noticeable limp. Oddly enough, it has taken me years to accept my new position. I find I no longer have A-D-A Ada, the mystery of coming and going. Along with my split-body drag, I lost my ability to read in the old way. When I open a book, the words sort themselves into narrow-minded single file on the page. The mirror image poems erase themselves half-formed in my mind. I miss those poems. Sometimes at night, in secret, I still limp purposefully around my apartment like Mr. Hyde, trying to recover my old ways of seeing and thinking. Like Jekyll, I crave that particular darkness curled up within me. Sometimes it almost comes. The books on the shelf rise up in solid lines of singing color. The world drops out, and its hidden shapes snap forward to meet my eyes. But it never lasts. By morning light, the books are all hunched together again with their spines turned out, fossilized, inanimate. No one else misses ADA, Ada, not even Mother. She seems thoroughly pleased to see the crumpled bird she delivered finally straighten up and fly right. But I liked how I was, I tell her. Oh, Ada, I loved you too. I never thought less of you, but I wanted better for you. Don't we have a cheerful, simple morality here in Western civilization? Expect perfection and revile the missed mark. Ada, the poor thing, hemiplegious, egregious, besiegeous. Recently it has been decided, grudgingly, that dark skin or lameness may not be entirely one's fault, but one still ought to show the good manners to act ashamed. When Jesus cured those crippled beggars, didn't they always get up and dance off stage, jabbing their canes sideways and waggling their top hats? Hooray! All better now! Hooray! If you are whole, you will argue, why wouldn't they rejoice? Don't the poor miserable buggers all want to be like me? Not necessarily, no. The arrogance of the able-bodied is staggering. Yes, maybe we'd like to be able to get places quickly and carry things in both hands, but only because we have to keep up with the rest of you or get the verse. We would rather be just like us and have that be all right. How can I explain that my two unmatched halves used to add up to more than one whole? In Congo, I was one half Banduka the Crooked Walker and one half Bendica, the sleek bird that dipped in and out of the banks with a crazy ungrace that took your breath. We both had our good points. Here there is no good name for my gift, so it died without a proper ceremony. I am now the good Dr. Price, seeing straight, conceding to be in my right mind. And how can I invent my version of the story without my crooked vision? How is it right to slip free of an old skin and walk away from the scene of the crime? We came, we saw, we took away, and we left behind. We must be allowed our anguish and our regrets. Mother keeps wanting to wash herself clean, but she clings to her clay and her dust. Mother is still ruthless. She claims I am her youngest now, but she is still clutching her baby. She will put down that burden, I believe, on the day she hears forgiveness from Ruth May herself. As soon as I came back, I drove down to see her. We sat together on her bony couch with my photographs of Africa, picking through and laying them out, making a tide pool of shiny color among the seashells on her coffee table. Leah's thin, I reported, but she still walks too fast. How is Rachel holding up? That is a good question. In spite of remarkable intervening circumstances, I said, if Rachel ever gets back to Bethlehem for a high school reunion, she will win the prize for Changed the Least. Mother handled the photos with mostly casual interest, except for the ones that showed my sisters. Over these, she paused for an extremely long time, as if she were listening to small, silent confessions. Finally, I made mine. I told her he had died. She was strangely uncurious about the details, but I gave her most of them anyway. She sat looking puzzled. "I have some pansies I need to set out," she said then, and let the screen door bang as she walked out to the back porch. I followed and found her in her old straw gardening hat, a trowel already in one hand, and the flat of pansies balanced in the other. She ducked under the tangled honeysuckle toward the garden path, using her trowel like a machete to hack through some overgrown vines that crowded her jungly little porch. We marched purposefully down her little path to the lettuce bed by the gate, where she knelt in the leaf mold and began punching holes in the ground. I squatted nearby, watching. Her hat had a wide straw brim and a crown completely blown out, as if whatever was in her head had exploded many times. "Leah says he would have wanted to go that way," I said, "a blaze of glory." "I don't give a damn what he would have wanted." "Oh," I said. The damp ground soaked the knees of her jeans in large dark patches that spread like bloodstains as she worked. "Are you sorry he's dead?" "Ada, what can it possibly mean to me now?" "Then what are you sorry about?" She lifted seedlings out of the flat, untangling their nets of tender white roots. Her bare hands worked them into the ground, prodding and gentling as if putting to bed an endless supply of small children. She wiped the tears off both sides of her face with the back of her left hand, leaving dark lines of soil along her cheekbones. "To live is to be marked," she said without speaking. "To live is to change, to die 100 deaths. I am a mother. You aren't. He wasn't." "Do you want to forget?" She paused her work, resting her trowel on her knee, and looked at me. "Are we allowed to remember?" "Who's to say we can't?" "Not one woman in Bethlehem ever asked me how Ruth May died. Did you know that?" "I guess. And all those people I worked with in Atlanta on civil rights and African relief, we never once spoke of my having a crazy evangelist husband still in the Congo somewhere. People knew, but it was embarrassing to them. I guess they thought it was some awful reflection on me." "The sins of the father," I said. "The sins of the father are not discussed. That's how it is." She returned to her business of stabbing the earth. "I know she is right. Even the Congo has tried to slip out of her old flesh, to pretend it isn't scarred. Congo was a woman in shadows, dark-hearted, moving to a drumbeat. Zaire is a tall young man tossing salt over his shoulder. All the old injuries have been renamed Kinshasa, Kisangani. There never was a King Leopold, no brash Stanley. Bury them, forget. You have nothing to lose but your chains." "But I don't happen to agree." "If chained is where you have been, your arms will always bear marks of the shackles. What you have to lose is your story, your own slant. You'll look at the scars on your arms and see mere ugliness, or you'll take great care to look away from them and see nothing. Either way, you have no words for the story of where you came from. "I'll discuss it," I said. "I despised him. He was a despicable man." "Well, Ada, you could always call a spade a spade. Do you know when I hated him the most? When he used to make fun of my books, my reading and writing, and when he hit any of us, you especially. I imagined getting the kerosene and burning him up in his bed. I only didn't because you were in it, too." She looked up at me from under her hat brim. Her eyes were a wide, hard granite blue. "It's true," I said. I pictured it clearly. I could smell the cold kerosene and feel it soaking the sheets. I still can. "Then why didn't you? Both of us together. You might as well have. Because then you would be free, too, and I didn't want that. I wanted you to remember what he did to us." Tall and straight I may appear, but I will always be ADA Ada inside. A crooked little person trying to tell the truth. The power is in the balance. We are our injuries as much as we are our successes. Leah Price Ngemba, Kimvula District, Zaire, 1986. I have four sons, all named for men we lost to war. Pascal, Patrice, Martin Luther, Nathaniel. Nathaniel is our miracle. He was born last year, a month early, after his long, bumpy, upside-down ride in the Land Rover that moved our family from Kinshasa to the farm in Kimvula District. We were still 10 kilometers from the village when my chronic backache spread to a deep, rock-hard contraction across my lower belly, and I understood with horror that I was in labor. I got out and walked very slowly behind the truck to subdue my panic. Anatole must have been worried sick by my bizarre conduct, but it's no use arguing with a woman in labor, so he got out and walked with me while the boys bickered over who would drive the truck. I can vaguely recall its twin red taillights ahead of us on the dark jungle road, bumping along tediously, and the false starts of an afternoon thundershower. After a while, without saying anything, I went to the side of the road and lay down on a pile of damp leaves between the tall buttressed roots of a kapok tree. Anatole knelt next to my head and stroked my hair. "You should get up. It's dark and damp here, and our clever sons have gone off and left us." I raised my head and looked for the truck, which was indeed gone. There was something I needed to explain to Anatole, but I couldn't be bothered with it at the peak of a contraction. Straight overhead was the tree with its circle of limbs radiating out from the great pale trunk. I counted my way around that circle of branches like numbers on the face of a clock, slowly, one deep breath for each number. 17. A very long minute, maybe an hour. The contraction subsided. "Anatole," I said, "I mean to have this baby right here and now." "Oh, Beene, you have never had any patience at all." The boys drove on for some time before stopping and backing up by the grace of God and Martin Luther. He'd lost the argument about driving and was pouting out the back window when it dawned on him to shout for his brother to stop. "Wait, wait, Mama must be having the baby." Anatole threw things around madly in the truck before finding an elephant grass mat and some shirts. At least we had with us everything we owned, and it was clean. He made me sit up so he could tuck these things under me. I don't remember it. I only remember my thighs tensing and my pelvis arching forward with that sudden thunderous urge that is so much more powerful than any other human craving, the need to push. I heard a roar, which I suppose was me, and then Nathaniel was here with us, bloodying a clean white shirt of Anatole's and an old soft panier printed with yellow birds. Anatole did a laughing, backward-hopping dance of congratulation. It wasn't yet quite a year since his release from Camp Hardy, and he was sympathetic to his son's eager escape from solitary confinement. But the baby was weak. Anatole immediately settled down to driving us anxiously through the dark while I curled around our suckling boy in the back seat, alarmed to see he wasn't even that. He couldn't nurse. By the time we arrived in Kimvula, he felt feverish. From there, he wasted very quickly to a lethargic little bundle of skin-covered bones and a gaunt, skin-covered skull. He didn't even cry. The next many days and nights ran together for me because I was terrified to put him down at all, or even to fall asleep holding him for fear he'd slip away. Anatole and I took turns rocking his limp little body, talking to him, trying to coax him into the world of the living. Martin insisted on taking his turn, too, rocking and whispering boy secrets into the little printed blanket. But Nathaniel was hard to convince. Twice he stopped breathing altogether. Anatole blew into his mouth and massaged his chest until he gasped faintly and came back. After a week he began to eat, and now seems to have no regrets about his decision to stay with us. But during that terrible first week of his life, I was racked with the miseries of a weak, sore body and a lost soul. I could recollect having promised some god or other more than once that if I could only have Anatole back, I would never ask for another thing on this earth. Now here I was, banging on heaven's door again. A desolate banging from a girl who could count the years since she felt any real presence on the other side of that door. One night, as I sat on the floor, rocking, sleepless, deranged by exhaustion, cradling this innocent wreck of a baby, I just started to talk out loud. I talked to the fire. Fire, fire, fire. Please keep him warm. Eat all the wood you need, and I'll get more, but just don't go out. Keep this little body I already love so much from going cold. I spoke in English, fairly certain I'd gone mad entirely. I spoke to the moon outside and the trees, to the sleeping bodies of Anatole and Patrice and Martin, and finally to the kettle of boiled sterile water and tiny dropper I was using to keep the baby from dehydrating. Suddenly, I had a fully formed memory of my mother kneeling and talking, praying, I believe, to a bottle of antibiotics when Ruth May was so sick. I could actually hear Mother's breath and her words. I could picture her face very clearly and feel her arms around me. Mother and I prayed together to whatever it is that we have. This was enough. If God is someone who thinks of me at all, he must think of me as a mother. Scraping fiercely for food and shelter, mad entirely for love, by definition. My boys all cry, "Salam vote," as they run out the door, away from my shelter and advice, but never escaping my love. Pascal has gone farthest. For 2 years he's been in Luanda, where he studies petroleum engineering, and I sincerely believe chases girls. He reminds me so much of his namesake, my old friend, with similar wide-set eyes and the same cheerful question breaking like a fresh egg upon each new day. Beto nki tutasala. What are we doing? Patrice is just the opposite, studious, sober, and an exact physical copy of his father. He wants to study government and be a minister of justice in a very different Africa from this one. I go weak in the knees with dread and admiration, watching him sharpen his hopes. But it's Martin Luther who's turning out to be the darkest of my sons, in complexion and temperament. At 12, he broods and writes poetry in a journal like his father's hero, Agostinho Neto. He reminds me of his Aunt Ada. Here in Kimvula District, we're working with farmers on a soybean project, trying to establish a cooperative, a tiny outpost of reasonable sustenance in the belly of Mobutu's beast. It's futile, probably. If the government catches wind of any success here, the Minister of Agriculture will rob us out of existence. So we quietly plant our hopes out here in the jungle, just a few kilometers from the Angolan border, at the end of an awful road where Mobutu's spies won't often risk their fancy cars. We count our small successes from day to day. Anatole has reorganized the secondary school, which had been in pure collapse for 10 years. Hardly a young adult in Kimvula Village can read. I'm busy with my ravenous Tanyel, who nurses night and day, riding in his sling on one side or the other so he won't have to pause while I boil his diapers. Patrice and Martin have been commandeered by their father to teach French and mathematics respectively, even though this puts Martin in charge of children older than himself. Myself, I'm just happy to be living among fruit trees and cooking with wood again. I don't mind the satisfying exhaustions of carrying wood and water. It's the other exhaustion I hate, the endless news of Mobutu's excesses and the costs of long-term deprivation. People here are instinctively more fearful and less generous than they were 20 years ago in Kilanga. Neighbor women do still come calling to offer little gifts, a hand of bananas or an orange for the baby to suck on and make us laugh at his puckery face. But their eyes narrow as they look around the room. Never having known a white person before, they assume I must know Mobutu and all important Americans personally. In spite of my protests, I think they worry I'll report to someone that they had an orange to spare. There's nothing like living as a refugee in one's own country to turn a generous soul into a hard little fist. Zairians are tired to death. You can see it anywhere you look. Our house here is mud and thatch, plenty large, with two rooms and a kitchen shed. A happier place for sure than the tin and cement box that packaged us up with all our griefs in Kinshasa. There, the cranky indoor plumbing constantly grumbled at us like God to Noah threatening the deluge, and Anatole swore if he lived through 10,000 mornings in Kinshasa, he would never get used to defecating in the center of his home. Honestly, a latrine does seem like a return to civilization. But our life in this village feels provisional. We have one foot over the border into the promised land, or possibly the grave. Our plan is to pack up our truck again and drive from here to Sansapombo, Angola, as soon as we possibly can. There we'll keep our hands busy in a new independent nation whose hopes coincide with our own. We've been leaning toward Angola for 10 years now. Anatole had a chance to serve in the new government there in 1975, right after the treaty that gave NATO the presidency. But Anatole wasn't yet ready to abandon the Congo. And then NATO died, too young. In 1982, another invitation came from the second president, José dos Santos. Anatole was prevented from accepting that post by the inconvenience of living in a 2-meter square room with a bucket of his excrement for company in the Teesville Penitentiary. I don't believe Anatole has many regrets, but he would have been proud to work with NATO or dos Santos. Thanks to those remarkable men, plus others uncounted who died on the way, Angola has wrested itself free of Portugal and still owns its diamonds and oil wells. The industry of Angolans doesn't subsidize foreigners or any castles with moats, and their children are likely to get vaccinations and learn to read. They're still desperately poor, of course. They kept their diamonds and oil at a horrific cost. None of us predicted what came to pass there. Least of all, Neto, the young doctor-poet who just meant to spare his people from the scarring diseases of smallpox and humiliation. He went to the U.S. looking for help and was shown the door. So he came home to try to knock down Portuguese rule on his own and create a people's Angola. Then he got some attention from the Americans. For now, he was a communist devil. 10 years ago, when Anatole received that first letter stamped with the new official seal of the Presidency of Independent Angola, it looked like dreams could come true. After 600 years of their own strife and a few centuries of Portuguese villainy, the warring tribes of Angola had finally agreed to a peace plan. Agostinho Neto was president in an African nation truly free of foreign rule. We so nearly packed up and went that very day. We were desperate to move our sons to a place where they could taste hope, at least, if not food. But within 2 weeks of the peace agreement, the United States violated it. They airlifted a huge shipment of guns to an opposition leader who vowed personally to murder NATO. On the day we heard this, I sat sobbing in our kitchen, flattened with shame and rage. Patrice came and sat on the floor by my chair, patting my leg with a little boy's solemn endurance. Mama, mama, ne pleure pas. Ce n'est pas de la faute de grand-mère, mama. It didn't even occur to him to connect me with American disgrace. He thought I was angry at Mother and Ada. He looked up at me with his narrow little face and almond eyes, and there was his father years and years and years ago saying, "Not you, Bainey." But who, if not me? And for how many generations must we be forgiven by our children? Murdering Lumumba, keeping Mobutu in power, starting it all over again in Angola. These sound like plots between men, but they are betrayals, by men, of children. It's $30 million, Anatole told me recently, that the U.S. has now spent trying to bring down Angola's sovereignty. Every dollar of it had to come from some person, a man or woman. How does this happen? They think of it as commerce, I suppose, a matter of hardware, the plastic explosives and landmines one needs to do the job. Or it's a commerce of imagined dreads, the Bethlehem housewives somehow convinced that a distant black communist devil will cost them some quarter in their color-matched living rooms. But what could it possibly have mattered to them that after the broken treaty and NATO's desperate plea for help, the Cubans were the only ones to answer it? We cheered, the boys and Anatole and our neighbors, all jumping and screaming in our yard when the radio said the planes had come into Luanda. There were teachers and nurses on board with boxes of smallpox vaccine. We imagine them liberating Angola and marching right on up the Congo River to vaccinate us all. Rachel informs me I've had my brains washed by a communist plot. She's exactly right. I've been won to the side of schoolteachers and nurses and lost all allegiance to plastic explosives. No homeland I can claim as mine would blow up a struggling distant country's hydroelectric dams and water pipes, inventing darkness and dysentery in the service of its ideals, and bury mines in every Angolan road that connected food with a hungry child. We've watched this war with our hearts and our throats, knowing what there is to lose. Another Congo. Another wasted chance running like poisoned water under Africa, curling our souls into fists. But with nothing else to hope for, we lean toward Angola, waiting while the past grows heavy and our future narrows down to a crack in the door. We're poised on the border with everything we might need for an eventual destiny assembled around us. We have cots, the table and chairs we acquired in Kinshasa, a collection of agriculture books and teaching tools from Bikoki, my ancient suitcase of family treasures salvaged from Kilunga. Anatole has even kept the globe I gave him for a wedding present, painted by my own hand, on a calabash while the nuns prayed their novenas. Their weird library had Saint-Exupéry, but nothing so secular as an atlas of the world, so I had to work from memory. Later, my sons sat upon it like apprentice palm readers, trying to divine the fate of their world from the links and curves of its rivers. Miraculously, it survives the humidity and our moves, with only a few unwarranted archipelagos of gray mold dotting its oceans. Anatole cherishes it, and the astonishing fact that I was the first to tell him the shape of our world. But when I see it on his table, I'm taken aback by what I overlooked at age 18. The Caspian Sea, for example, the Urals, Balkans, Pyrenees, whole mountain ranges vanished under my negligence. But the Congo is exactly the right shape and size in relation to Europe and the Americas. Already, I was determined, I guess, to give Africa a fair shake. We are all still the children we were, with plans we keep secret even from ourselves. Anatole's, I think, is to outlive Mobutu and come back here when we can stand on this soil and say home without the taste of gold-leaf chandeliers and starvation burning bitter on the backs of our tongues. And mine, I think, is to leave my house one day unmarked by whiteness and walk on a compassionate earth with Ruth May beside me, bearing me no grudge. Maybe I'll never get over my grappling for balance, never stop believing life is going to be fair the minute we can clear up all these mistakes of the temporarily misguided. Like the malaria I've never shaken off, it's in my blood. I anticipate rewards for goodness and wait for the acts of punishment to fall upon evil, in spite of the years I've rocked in this cradle of rewarded evils and murdered goodness. Just when I start to feel jaded to life as it is, I'll suddenly wake up in a fever, look out at the world, and gasp at how much has gone wrong that I need to fix. I suppose I loved my father too much to escape being molded to at least some part of his vision. But the practice of speaking a rich tonal language to my neighbors has softened his voice in my ear. I hear the undertones now that shimmer under the surface of the words right and wrong. We used to be baffled by Kikongo words with so many different meanings. Bangala for most precious and most insufferable and also poison wood. That one word brought down Father's sermons every time as he ended them all with the shout, Tata Jesus is Bangala! Way back then, while Rachel could pull words out of thin air to mean what she pleased, and Ruth May was inventing her own, Ada and I were trying to puzzle out how everything you thought you knew means something different in Africa. We worried over Nzolo. It means dearly beloved, or a white grub used for fish bait, or a special fetish against dysentery, or little potatoes. Nzole is the double-sized poignet that wraps around two people at once. Finally, I see how these things are related. In a marriage ceremony, husband and wife stand tightly bound by their Nzole and hold one another to be the most precious, Nzolani. As precious as the first potatoes of the season, small and sweet like Georgia peanuts. Precious as the fattest grubs turned up from the soil which catch the largest fish. And the fetish most treasured by mothers against dysentery contains a particle of all the things invoked by the word Nzolo. You must dig and dry the grub and the potatoes, bind them with a thread from your wedding cloth, and have them blessed in a fire by the Nganga doctor. Only by life's best things are your children protected, this much I surely believe. Each of my peanut brown babies I called my Nzolani, and said it with the taste of fish and fire and new potatoes in my mouth. There is no other possibility now. Everything you're sure is right can be wrong in another place, especially here. I say this frequently while I'm boiling diapers in the kitchen house and having my imaginary arguments with an absent Rachel, which are not so different from arguments with Rachel in person. She reminds me once again of the communist threat. I walk outside to dump the water and wave at my neighbor who's boiling peanuts in a hubcap. Both of us cower at the sound of tires. It might be the black Mercedes of the Casque Bleu. Mobutu's deputies come to take our measly harvest to help finance another palace. And then it comes to me suddenly from childhood, my first stammering definition of communism to Anatole. They do not fear the Lord, and they think everybody should have the same kind of house. From where I'm standing, sister, it's hard to fathom the threat. I live in a tiny house piled high with boys, potatoes, fetishes, and books of science, a wedding cloth, a disintegrating map of the world, an ancient leather suitcase of memories, a growing accumulation of past crowding out our ever-narrowing future. And our waiting is almost over. It's taken 10 years and seems like a miracle, but the Americans are losing in Angola. Their landmines are still all over the country. They take off the leg or the arm of a child every day, and I know what could happen to us if we travel those roads. But in my dreams, I still have hope, and in life, no safe retreat. If I have to hop all the way on 1 foot, damn it, I'll find a place I can claim as home. Book 6, Song of the Three Children. All that you have brought upon us and all that you have done to us, you have done in justice. Deliver us in your wonderful way. Song of the Three Children, 7 through 19, The Apocrypha. Rachel Price, The Equatorial. I'm forever getting compliments on my spotless complexion, but let me tell you a little secret. It takes more work than anything in this world to keep yourself well preserved. Gee, so man, nothing like turning 50 to make you feel 100 years old. Not that I was about to put candles on a cake and burn the place down. I got through that day without telling a soul. Now I've closed the bar, and here I sit with my lucky strike and my sandal hanging off my toe, and I can always look back on it as just one more day like any other. But it sure gives you something to compensate upon. Did I ever think I would wind up here getting old? Not on your life, but here I am. I've walked off more marriages and close calls than you can shake a stick at, but never got out of the dark continent. I've settled down here and gotten to be such a stick in the mud I don't even like to go out. Last week I was forced to drive down to Brazzaville for the liquor order because I honestly could not find a driver trustworthy to come back with the liquor and car in one piece. But there was a flood on the way and 2 trees across the road, and when I finally got back here, I kissed the floor of the bar. I did, I swear. Mostly I kissed it for still being there, since I still expect every plank of this place to be carried off by my own help during my absence, but so far so good. At least I can say that I'm a person who can look around and see what she's accomplished in this world. Not to boast, but I have created my own domain. I call the shots. There may be a few little faults in the plumbing and minor discrepancies among the staff, but I'm very confident of my service. I have a little sign in every room telling guests they're expected to complain at the office between the hours of 9 and 11 a.m. daily. And do I hear a peep? No. I run a tight ship. That is one thing I have to be proud of. And number two, I'm making a killing. Three, there's no time to get lonely. Like I said, same old face in the mirror, 50 years old, and she doesn't look a day over 90. Ha ha. Do I ever think about the life I missed in the good old USA? Practically every day would be my answer. Oh, goodness, the parties, the cars, the music, the whole carefree American way of life. I've missed being a part of something you could really believe in. When we finally got TV here, for a long while they ran Dick Clark and the American Bandstand every afternoon at 4 o'clock. I'd lock up the bar, make myself a double Singapore sling, settle down with a paper fan, and practically swoon with grief. I know how to do those hairstyles. I really could have been something in America. Then why not go back? Well, now it's too late, of course. I have responsibilities. First there was one husband and then another to tie me down, and then the Equatorial, which isn't just a hotel. It's like running a whole little country where everybody wants to run off with a piece for themselves the minute you turn your back. The very idea of my things being scattered over hill and down dale through the jungle, my expensive French pressure cooker all charred to tarnation boiling manioc over some stinky fire, and my nice chrome countertops ending up as the roof of somebody's shack. No, thank you. I can't bear the thought. You make something, seems like, and spend the rest of your days toiling so it won't go all unraveled. One thing leads to another, then you're mired in. Years ago, when things first started going sour with Axelrod, that was probably when I should have gone home. I didn't have anything invested in Africa yet but a little old apartment boudoir decorated to the best of my abilities in blush pink. Right then, I could have tried to talk him into moving back to Texas, where he supposedly had some kind of ties according to his passport, which turned out to be almost entirely false. Better yet, I could have gone by myself. Hell's bells, I could have sashayed out the door without so much as a howdy-do, since technically speaking we were only married in the biblical sense. Even back then I knew some gentlemen in high places that could have helped me scrounge up the plane fare, and then, before you could say Jack Robinson Crusoe, I'd have been back in Bethlehem, sharing a shack with Mother and Ada with my tail between my legs. Oh, sure, I'd have to hear them say I told you so about Axelrod, but I've swallowed my pride before, that's for sure. I've done it so many times I'm practically lined with my mistakes on the inside like a bad wallpapered bathroom. I had my bags packed more than once, but when push came to shove, I was always afraid. Of what? Well, it's hard to explain. Scared I wouldn't be able to fit back in is the long and short of it. I was only 19 or 20 at that time. My high school friends would still have been whining over boyfriends and fighting for car hop jobs at the A&W. Their idea of a dog-eat-dog world was beauty school. And now here comes Rachel with stained hair and one dead sister and a whole darn marriage behind her already, not to mention hell and high water, not to mention the Congo. My long tramp through the mud left me tuckered out and just too worldly wise to go along with the teen scene. What was it like over there? I could just hear them asking. What would I say? Well, the ants nearly ate us alive. Everybody we knew kept turning up dead of one disease or another. The babies all got diarrhea and plumb dried up. When we got hungry, we'd go shoot animals and strip off their hides. Let's face it, I could never have been popular again at home. The people I'd always chummed around with would stop speaking to you if they so much as suspected you'd ever gone poo behind a bush. If I wanted to fit in, I'd have to pretend, and I'm no good at play acting. Leah could always do that. She'd take the high road to please father or her teachers or God or maybe just to prove she could do it. And Ada, of course, play-acted at not talking for years and years merely to be ornery. But if it was me, I'd never remember who I was trying to be. Before the day was out, I'd forget and blurt out my own true feelings. This is off the subject, but do you know who I always really felt for? Those soldier boys that went back to the States after Vietnam. I read about that. Everybody was crying, "Peace, brother." And here they'd been in the jungle watching fungus eat up the dead bodies. I know just how they felt. Personally, I didn't need that. I'm the type of person where you just never look back, and I've become a success in my own right. I've had opportunities as a woman of the world. An ambassador's wife, imagine that. Those girls back in Bethlehem must be getting old and gray, still loading their Maytags and running after their kids or even grandkids by now and still wishing they were Bridget Bardot, whereas I have actually been in the Foreign Service. I never was able to have children. That is one thing I do regret. I've had very bad female problems on account of an infection I contracted from Eben Axelrod. Like I said, I paid my price with him. There's never a dull moment here at the Equatorial, though. Who needs children when you have monkeys rushing into the dining room to steal the very food off your guests' plates? This has happened on more than one occasion. Among the variety of animals I keep in cages in the garden, I have four monkeys and a bat-eared fox that will escape on the slightest pretense from the boy who cleans out the cages. Into the restaurant they'll run, screaming, the poor fox running for his life, but the monkeys all too easily diverted by the sight of some fresh fruit. They'll even pause to grab a bottle of beer and drink it down. One time I returned from a trip to the market to find my two vervet monkeys, Princess Grace and General Mills, teetering drunk on a table while a group of German coffee plantation owners sang Roll Out the Barrel. Well, I'll tell you, I tolerate just about any kind of good times my guests wish to have, since that's how we keep our heads above water in this business, but I made those German gentlemen pay for the damage. Ever so often, a group of fellows will stop by in the afternoon on a sightseeing tour and receive a mistaken impression of my establishment. This only happens with newcomers who are unfamiliar with the Equatorial. They take one look at me, stretched out by the pool with all the keys on a chain around my neck, and one look at my pretty young cooks and chambermaids on their afternoon break, lounging against the patio wall between the geraniums, and guess what? They'll take me for the madam of a whorehouse. Believe you me, I give them a piece of my mind. If this looks like a house of prostitution to you, I tell them, that just shows the quality of your own moral fiber. I have to admit, though, it's funny in a certain way. I'm no longer as young as I might have been, but if I do say so, I have never let myself go. I guess I should be flattered if some fellow peeks around the garden wall and thinks he spies Jezebel. Oh, if Father could see me now, wouldn't he give me the verse? I'm afraid all those childhood lessons in holiness slid off me like hot butter off the griddle. I sometimes wonder if dear old Dad's turning in his grave or whatever he's in. I'm sure he expected me to grow up as a nice church lady with cute little hats organizing good deeds. But sometimes life doesn't give you all that many chances at being good. Not here, anyway. Even Father learned that one the hard way. He came on strong thinking he'd save the children, and what does he do but lose his own? That's the lesson right there. If you take a bunch of practically grown red-blooded daughters to Africa, don't you think at least some of them are going to marry or what have you and end up staying? You can't just sashay into the jungle aiming to change it all over to the Christian style without expecting the jungle to change you right back. Oh, I see it time and again with the gentlemen who come through here on business. Some fella thinks he's going to be the master of Africa and winds up with his nice European tailored suit rumpled in a corner and his wits half cracked from the fillets itching under his skin. If it was as easy as they thought it was going to be, why, they'd be done by now and Africa would look just like America with more palm trees. Instead, most of it still looks exactly how it did a zillion years ago. Whereas, if you think about it, the Africans are running all over America right now, having riots for their civil rights and predominating the sports and popular music industries. From the very first moment I set foot in the Congo, I could see we were not in charge. We got swept up with those people that took us to the church for all their half-naked dancing and goat meat with the hair still on, and I said to myself, this little trip is going to be the ruin of the Price family as we know it. And boy, was it ever. Father's mistake, you see, was to try to convert the whole entire shebang over into just his exact way of thinking. He always said, girls, you choose your path and stick to it and suffer your consequences. Well, if he's finally dead now and laid to rest in some African voodoo cemetery, or worse yet, eaten up by the wild animals, well, amen. I guess that's about as consequential as it gets. The way I see Africa, you don't have to like it, but you sure have to admit it's out there. You have your way of thinking, and it has its, and never the train you shall meet. You just don't let it influence your mind. If there's ugly things going on out there, well, you put a good stout lock on your door and check it twice before you go to sleep. You focus on getting your own one little place set up perfect, as I have done, and you'll see, other people's worries do not necessarily have to drag you down. I amaze myself sometimes at what I have personally been through and still remain in one piece. Sometimes I really do think I owe the secret of my success to that little book I read long ago called How to Survive 101 Calamities. Simple remedies for dire situations, that's the lesson. In a fallen elevator, try to climb up on the person nearby so their body will cushion your landing. Or in a crowded theater, when everybody's hightailing it for the fire exit, stick your elbows hard into the ribs of your neighbors to wedge yourself in, then pick up your feet so you won't get trampled. That is how people frequently lose their lives in a riot. Somebody steps on your heel, then walks right up till you're flat and they're standing on you. That's what you get for trying to stand on your own two feet. You end up getting crushed. So that's my advice. Let others do the pushing and shoving, and you just ride along. In the end, the neck you save will be your own. Perhaps I sound unchristian, but let's face it. When I step outside my own little world at night and listen to the sounds out there in the dark, what I feel down in my bones is that this is not a Christian kind of place. This is darkest Africa, where life roars by you like a flood and you grab whatever looks like it'll hold you up. If you ask me, that's how it is and ever shall be. You stick out your elbows and hold yourself up. Leah Price, Sansa Pombo, Angola. Once upon a time, Anatole says in the dark, and I close my eyes and fly away on his stories. It's almost a shock to be alone together in our bed, practically elderly, after almost 30 years of little elbows and heels and hungry mouths. When Taniel turned 10, he abandoned us for a cot of his own, full of rocks that fall out of his pockets. Most boys his age still sleep on the pile of their families, but Taniel was adamant. My brothers have beds to themselves. He doesn't realize they've moved on from solitude. Even Martin, now at college, has a girlfriend. With his curly head cocked forward, bent on keeping up and trying to eat the world in one bite, he takes my breath away. He's so much like Ruth May. And in our bed, which Anatole calls the New Republic of Canubia, my husband tells me the history of the world. Usually we start with 500 years ago, when the Portuguese came poking the nose of their little wooden ship into the mouth of the Congo River. Anatole peers from side to side, pantomiming Portuguese astonishment. What did they see? I always ask, although I already know. They saw Africans, men and women black as night, strolling in bright sunlight along the riverbanks, but not naked, just the opposite. They wore hats, soft boots, and more layers of exotic skirts and tunics than would seem bearable in the climate. This is the truth. I've seen the drawings published by those first adventurers after they hurried back home to Europe. They reported that the Africans lived like kings, even wearing the fabrics of royalty, velvet, damask, and brocade. Their report was only off by a hair. The Congo people made remarkable textiles by beating the fibrous bark of certain trees or weaving thread from the raffia palm. From mahogany and ebony they made sculpture and furnished their homes. They smelted and forged iron ore into weapons, plowshares, flutes, and delicate jewelry. The Portuguese marveled at how efficiently the Kingdom of Congo collected taxes and assembled its court and ministries. There was no written language, but an oral tradition so ardent that when the Catholic fathers fixed letters to the words of Kikongo, its poetry and stories poured into print with the force of a flood. The priests were dismayed to learn the Congo already had their own Bible. They'd known it by heart for hundreds of years. Impressed as they were with the Kingdom of Congo, the Europeans were dismayed to find no commodity agriculture here. All food was consumed very near to where it was grown, and so no cities, no giant plantations, and no roads necessary for transporting produce from the one to the other. The kingdom was held together by thousands of miles of footpaths crossing the forest, with suspension bridges of woven vines swinging quietly over the rivers. I picture it as Anatole describes it. Men and women in tiers of velvet skirts walking noiselessly on a forest path. Sometimes when I have relapses of my old demon, I lie in the crook of his arm and he comforts me this way, talking to me all night long to stave off the bad dreams. Quinine just barely keeps my malaria in check, and there are resistant strains here now. The fever dreams are always the same, the first warning that I'll soon be knocked on my back. The old blue hopelessness invades my sleep, and I'm crossing the river, looking back at the faces of children begging for food. Cadeau! Cadeau! But then I wake up in our nation of two, enclosed in our mosquito tents, slanted plains, lit silver by moonlight, and always think of Bulungu, where we first lay together like this. Anatole cradling me into forgiveness, while I rattled and shook with fever. Our marriage has been, for me, a very long convalescence. Now they are walking home, Beine, with baskets of palm nuts and orchids from the forest. They're singing. Songs about what? Oh, everything. The colors of a fish, and how well-behaved their children would be if they were all made of wax. I laugh. Who are they? How many? Just a woman and a man on the path. They are married. And their troublesome children aren't with them. Not yet. They have only been married 1 week. Oh, I see. So they're holding hands. Of course. What does it look like there? They are close to the river, in a forest that has never been cut down. These trees are 1,000 years old. Lizards and little monkeys live their whole lives up above without coming down to the ground, up in the roof of the world. But down on the path where we are, it's dark. A nice darkness, the kind your eyes can grow to like. It's raining, but the branches are so thick that only a little mist comes down. New mbika vines are curling up from the ground behind us where the water pools in our footsteps. What happens when we come to the river? We'll cross it, of course. I laugh. As easy as that. And what if the ferry is stuck without a battery on the other side? In the Kingdom of Congo, Beine, no batteries, no trucks, no roads. They declined to invent the wheel because it looked like nothing but trouble in this mud. For crossing the river, they have bridges that stretch from one great greenheart tree to another on the opposite bank. I can see this couple. I know they're real, that they really lived. They climb up to a platform in the Green Heart where the woman pauses for balance, bunches her long skirts into one hand, and prepares to walk out into the brighter light and rain. She touches her hair, which is braided in thick ropes and tied at the back of her neck with little bells. When she's ready, she steps out over the water on the swaying vine bridge. My heart rushes and then settles into the rhythm of her footsteps along the swinging bridge. But what if it's a huge river, I asked him once, like the Congo, which is much broader than the reach of any vine? This is simple, he said. Such a river should not be crossed. If only a river could go uncrossed, and whatever lay on the other side could live as it pleased, unwitnessed and unchanged. But it didn't happen that way. The Portuguese peered through the trees and saw that the well-dressed, articulate Congo did not buy or sell or transport their crops, but merely lived in place and ate what they had, like the beasts of the forest. In spite of poetry and beautiful clothes, such people were surely not fully human, were primitive. That's a word the Portuguese must have used to salve their conscience for what was to come. Soon the priests were holding mass baptisms on shore and marching their converts onto ships bound for sugar plantations in Brazil, slaves to the higher god of commodity agriculture. There is not justice in this world. Father, forgive me wherever you are, but this world has brought one vile abomination after another down on the heads of the gentle, and I'll not live to see the meek inherit anything. What there is in this world, I think, is a tendency for human errors to level themselves like water throughout their sphere of influence. That's pretty much the whole of what I can say, looking back. There's the possibility of balance. Unbearable burdens that the world somehow does bear with a certain grace. For 10 years now, we've been living in Angola, on an agricultural station outside of Sansa Pombo. Before independence, the Portuguese had a palm oil plantation here, cleared out of virgin jungle half century ago. Under the surviving oil palms, we grow maize, yams, soybeans, and raise pigs. Every year in the dry season, when travel is possible, our cooperative gains a few new families. Mostly young children and women with their poniers in tatters, they come soundlessly out of the forest, landing here as lightly as weary butterflies after years of fleeing the war. At first, they don't speak at all. Then after a week or two, the women usually begin to talk very softly but without cease until they've finished the accounting of places and people they've lost. Nearly always, I learn they've made a circular migration in their lifetimes, first having fled their home villages for the city, bluntly facing starvation there, and now returning to this small remote outpost where they have some hope of feeding themselves. We manage to produce a little extra palm oil for sale in Luanda, but most of what we grow is consumed here. The cooperative owns a single vehicle, our old Land Rover, which has had such a life it would tell its own history of the world if it could. But our rains start in September, and the road doesn't become passable again until April. Most of the year we look at what we have and decide to get along. We're not far from the border, and the people of this region look and speak so much as they did in Kalanga. I was dumbstruck when we first came here by a sense of childhood returned. I kept expecting someone I knew to come around the corner, Mama Mwanza, Nelson, Tata Bwanda in his red trousers, or most eerily, my father. Obviously, the boundary between Congo and Angola is nothing but a line on a map, the Belgians and Portuguese drawing their lots. The ancient Congo used to stretch across all of Central Africa. As a nation, it fell when 1 million of its healthiest citizens were sold into slavery. But its language and traditions did not. I wake up to the same bubbling Mbote shouted outside the open window of our station house. The women wrap and rewrap their poniers in the same way and press the palm oil harvest in the same kind of contraption that Mama Lo used. Often I hear ghosts, the upward slant of Pascal's voice in the question, Beto nki tutasala, what are we doing? I don't hear it often, though. In our village, there are very few boys of an age to climb trees for birds' nests, or girls stomping self-importantly down the road with a sibling clutched sideways like an oversized rag doll. I notice their absence everywhere. The war cost most of its lives among children under 10. That great, quiet void is moving slowly upward through us. A war leaves holes in so much more than the dams and roads that can be rebuilt. I teach classes in nutrition, sanitation, and soybeans to women who respectfully call me Mama Ngemba and ignore 9/10 of what I tell them. Our hardest task is teaching people to count on a future, to plant citrus trees and compost their wastes for fertilizer. This confused me at first. Why should anyone resist something so obvious as planting a fruit tree or improving the soil? But for those who've lived as refugees longer than memory, learning to believe in the nutrient cycle requires something close to a religious conversion. I ought to understand. I've been as transient in my adult life as anyone in our cooperative, and only now, after working this same land for 10 years, am I coming to understand the length and breadth of outsiders' failure to impose themselves on Africa. This is not Brussels or Moscow or Macon, Georgia. This is famine or flood. You can't teach a thing until you've learned that. The tropics will intoxicate you with the sweetness of frangipani flowers and lay you down with the sting of a viper, with hardly room to breathe in between. It's a great shock to souls gently reared in places of moderate climb, hope, and dread. The Portuguese were so shocked, evidently, that they stripped the gentle Congo and chained them down in rows in the dark for the passage. Condemned for their lack of cash crops. The Europeans couldn't imagine a reasonable society failing to take that step, and it's hard for us to imagine even now. In a temperate zone, it's the most natural thing in the world, right as rain, to grow fields of waving grain, to grow them year after year without dread of flood or plague, in soil that offers up green stems that bend to the scythe again and again, bread from a bottomless basket. Christians could invent and believe in the parable of the loaves and the fishes, for their farmers can trust in abundance and ship it to burgeoning cities where people can afford to spend their lives hardly noticing or caring that a seed produces a plant. Here you know what a seed is for, or you starve. A jungle yields no abundance to feed the multitudes and supports no leisure class. The soils are fragile, red laterite, and the rain is savage. Clearing a rainforest to plant annuals is like stripping an animal first of its fur, then its skin. The land howls. Annual crops fly on a wing and a prayer. And even if you manage to get a harvest, why, you need roads to take it out. Take one trip overland here and you'll know forever that a road in the jungle is a sweet, flat, impossible dream. The soil falls apart. The earth melts into red gashes like the mouths of whales. Fungi and vines throw a blanket over the face of the dead land. It's simple, really. Central Africa is a rowdy society of flora and fauna that have managed to balance together on a trembling geologic plate for 10 million years. When you clear off part of the plate, the whole slides into ruin. Stop clearing, and the balance slowly returns. Maybe in the long run, people will persist happily here only if they return to the ways of the ancient Congo, traveling by foot, growing their food near at hand, using their own tools and cloth near the site of production. I don't know. To be here without doing everything wrong requires a new agriculture, a new sort of planning, a new religion. I am the unmissionary, as Ada would say, beginning each day on my knees asking to be converted. Forgive me, Africa, according to the multitudes of thy mercies. If I could reach backward somehow to give Father just one gift, it would be the simple human relief of knowing you've done wrong and living through it. Poor Father, who was just one of a million men who never did catch on. He stamped me with a belief in justice, then drenched me in culpability, and I wouldn't wish such torment even on a mosquito. But that exacting, tyrannical God of his has left me for good. I don't quite know how to name what crept in to take his place. Some kin to the passion of Brother Fowles, I guess, who advised me to trust in creation, which is made fresh daily and doesn't suffer in translation. This God does not work in especially mysterious ways. The sun here rises and sets at 6 exactly. A caterpillar becomes a butterfly, a bird raises its brood in the forest, and a greenheart tree will only grow from a greenheart seed. He brings drought sometimes, followed by torrential rains, and if these things aren't always what I had in mind, they aren't my punishment either. They're rewards, let's say, for the patience of a seed. The sins of my fathers are not insignificant, but we keep moving on. As Mother used to say, not a thing stands still, but sticks in the mud. I move my hands by day, and by night, when my fever dreams come back and the river is miles below me, I stretch out over the water, making that endless crossing, reaching for balance. I long to wake up, and then I do. I wake up in love and work my skin to darkness under the equatorial sun. I look at my 4 boys, who are the colors of silt, loam, dust, and clay, an infinite palette for children of their own, and I understand that time erases whiteness altogether. Ada Price, Atlanta. A toad can die of light, Emily warned us as she peered out at the street from between her drawn curtains. Death is the common right of toads and men. Why swagger, then? My colleagues in medical school accused me of cynicism, but they had no idea. I am a babe in the woods, abandoned at the foot of a tree,